Well, on a blustery winter day, I think it's always nice to think about the out of doors and what the garden's going to look like next spring, all those flowers and maybe the trees and the lawn. Larry Mueller here. My guest today on this edition of Garden Talk is Ed Lyon. Ed directs the Allen Centennial Gardens, located on the UW-Madison campus. Kind of a hidden gem, I think, in some ways. We try to get information out on it, but I tell you, it's just a beautiful garden to visit. He started in July with this position, served as executive director of the Rotary Gardens at Janesville and directed education for Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. And he has his own consulting business, Spellbound Garden Writing and Consulting. So really pleased to have Ed stop by today to talk with you and with me about the Allen Centennial Gardens, but also to answer your gardening questions, especially as we talk flowers and shrubs and things of that nature. I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Ed Lyon, welcome. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
A lot of people obviously have visited the Allen Centennial Gardens, but many, many, many more have not. And give our listeners a little thumbnail of what we have there.
Sure. The gardens are set around a historic Victorian home. They're 2.5 acres. Usually when people ask me where they are, I direct them because we're relatively close to Babcock Hall. And if people don't know where anything else is, they usually know where the ice cream store is. And we're only a block off from there, right on Babcock Drive.
It's wonderful. And there's you have a chance to see a variety of types of gardens within the Centennial Garden.
That is correct. We have somewhere around 22 different themed gardens, and they can range from many of the things you'd expect to find in a botanic garden, like an English, Italian, French style gardens. We have probably what I think is the finest rock garden in the Midwest. We have also more natural type gardens, like a woodland garden. We have the pond. It's actually quite intense, 2.5 acres.
Yeah, it really is, and it's takes a while if you really want to look at everything. You're going to spend some time there. I really enjoy going there myself, and when we have visitors like this last summer, I have some visitors from Trinidad, the West Indies, visiting, and we spent several hours over at the Allen Centennial Garden. They were very impressed. It's a great place. Well, I tell you what, we have every line full, so let's go to the phones, and Joel in Milwaukee's up first. Joel, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll be renting a small plot, a garden plot, 15 feet by 10 feet, from a local nature organization called the Urban Ecology Center. And I've never gardened before, so I'm not sure how to begin. Like, I was thinking of mostly vegetables with one flower. I don't have a lot of room, but it looks like a lot to me since I've never done it before. And I want something that I can harvest, you know, this summer or fall. And I was thinking of some vegetables that, okay, I also belong to a CSA, if you've heard mm-hmm. of that.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I'd like vegetables that I don't get a lot of from the CSA, so at first I was thinking of, say, sweet potatoes, and but that takes a lot of room, it seems. And then I was also thinking of asparagus, but it seems like you don't get that get a good crop until the third year.
That's correct.
So would something like broccoli or parsnips? I mean,
yeah. All right. Well, let's see what Ed's got to say.
Well, first off, if you're just starting, 10 by 15 is probably plenty of room. And I need to ask, are you allowed to build on these plots? Can you build a raised bed, or do you have to utilize the ground as it is?
I believe, okay, this land used to be on, it's on the side of a bike path. The bike path used to be a railroad long ago, so it...
You don't know for sure. I would expect probably not.
If you can, if you can raise beds, you can pack in an awful lot more vegetables than you could in that 10 by 15 if you're just planting straight into the existing soil. But obviously, there are all kinds of vegetables that you can start and harvest next year. One of my suggestions, everybody absolutely loves tomatoes. But what you do is find a place where maybe you can either buy just a single tomato plant of various types. So if you're planting like six of them because you happen to buy six in a flat, you're going to get more tomatoes than you need. But one of the other things I would recommend is to look at some of the older varieties, what we call heirlooms. A lot of our heirloom vegetables are very popular right now. They have more flavor than some of the hybrids. Certainly your broccolis, your I definitely would not recommend sweet potato. We do not have a long enough growing season. You're going to really get a sweet potato. Again, asparagus, like you said, is a very long-term crop. Also, you have an excellent cooperative extension in Milwaukee. So I would definitely contact them. They'll have all kinds of publications that will help you as a beginner gardener in vegetable gardening as well.
Yeah, they go to your county extension office and check with them because there are a lot of publications. You can also go online. It's the University of Wisconsin Extension Learning Store. I just went online, and there's a bunch of publications that you could go to, or anybody can go to if you want to get some, and those you can just read online or copy them off for the most part. So good luck to you, Joel. Thank you very much for calling. And John in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
I want to be the first on my block to have a vegetable garden in my front yard. What things do I need to do?
Boy, fresh vegetables are on everybody's mind today.
Yeah.
I expect that might have something to do with all this snow. Well, I'll ask the same question. Do you have the capability of producing raised beds?
Yes.
Okay, I would definitely look into how to accomplish that. And again, extension and other resources in Milwaukee can certainly be of service. I would definitely go for raised beds if you can do that. Because of the depth of the soil that you can get in raised beds, many, whether it's root systems or root crops, they're going to go much deeper, and you can put more vegetables together in a small a spot.
Spot, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, have you raised vegetables before?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So you don't, obviously, educating yourself. We're heading into the time period, January and February, when you're going to see an awful lot of classes and people will have, whether it's garden centers that do them over the winter, public gardens will do classes as well. I always encourage people to educate themselves. There's this different symposia that are going on. We should all be getting our seed catalogs. I've been getting them right and left.
Yep.
Lately.
They're coming in.
So go through the seed catalog, see what kinds of plants that you want to put in that space, and take it from there.
Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, John. Yvonne and Brown Deer, we'll go to you next. Hi, Yvonne.
Okay. I have a whole list, so shut me up when I need to shut up. My basic thing that I was wondering about, last summer, my flowers, both perennials and annuals, seemed to be taller, and the color was definitely more intense. What's going on in the soil that we're getting that response?
Well, you're breaking up so badly, Yvonne. We're going to let it go at that. But Yvonne had some flower. Her flowers were taller and more, the colors more intense than past years.
We had an extremely dry July and August last year. Now, one thing that could make her flowers taller is if she was applying a lot of nitrogen fertilizer. That will certainly make plants stretch. The more intense color might have been because of the heat stress. Plants very often, when it's a hot summer, will have a more intense color because that pigmentation tends to intensify. It's protecting the cells of that plant when we're having a lot of heat and drought. So it could probably be a combination of those two things.
All right. All right. Thanks, Yvonne, for calling. And we'll go to Annette and Stevens Point next. Annette, hello to you.
Hello. We removed a few trees from the edge of our property to help our neighbors with open sun for solar panels, and we would like to know what deer-proof attractive shrubs you could recommend in that area.
There aren't any.
Yes, well, that's exactly true. In fact, this is when I do my lecturing and speaking around, this is the biggest question we get is deer and rabbits. And I'll take a couple of minutes here because this is a tremendous problem. There's we have nothing that we can call deer resistant. In fact, there's a nursery right now in Michigan that's calling themselves the deer resistant nursery. And I think they're setting themselves up for failure. The problem as most of you know, the deer are urbanizing. And one of the things that we do not recognize that deer have is a different palate as we do. So different deer are going to like different plants. What one deer eats in your yard, he may not necessarily like in somebody else's yard and vice versa. So you already have that issue. The other issue is these urbanized deer are now having their young in urbanized areas. Those young are growing up on an entirely different plant palate. So if anybody out there is telling you this is resistant to deer, then they're just setting themselves up for false information. The only thing you can really do is trial and error. And I hate to tell you that because that's really not good news. Everybody wants you to say, put in this shrub or this plant and the deer will not eat it. And for every time that I have held a class and I've told somebody this plant is deer resistant, somebody will invariably raise their hand and say they ate mine to the ground.
Yeah. So it's about, what about the materials? I think there's one called This One Really Works or something like that. You can spray on and...
There are certainly sprays. The challenges with the sprays are twofold. One is, first, you have to keep applying it. And if it's within the growing season, keep in mind, the only thing you've sprayed is the current foliage. And plants are growing all the time. So all the new foliage that this plant puts out is not sprayed. And that's what they like. They like the young foliage, and they're going to come and nibble that off on you anyway. So the other problem is, and if you get into the winter, is that that does not stay on the plant the entire season. Every rain or storm that you have or just time itself, it's going to come off the plant. So you need to keep running out there and spraying it. And if you have any quantity of plants and trees and shrubs in your yard, think about how many gallons of this stuff you'll be going through. So my best recommendation, and it is work in the fall, is to put wire around these plants in such a way that the deer can't get to them. Many people will also utilize burlap. Now, keep in mind, when we tell people to put burlap around plants, we do not mean wrap that burlap around the foliage. You actually create a sort of fence around it. It keeps them from wind burning and might also keep the deer and rabbits away as well.
So there you have it, Annette. Probably not the what you wanted to hear, but it's the truth.
That's right. And it's amazing. People want instant information, and it just doesn't no longer exist. They're sampling things all the time.
Ed Lyon, our guest today, talking with him about, well, flowers. We've talked a little about vegetables. We can talk about shrubs with him as well. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Ed Lyons, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, located on the UW-Madison campus. And Ed, we should mention there's a website that shows off a little bit the Allen Centennial Gardens and talks about it.
Yes, that's correct. I can't give it to you offhand because it's a fairly complicated because it goes actually through UW and the Horticultural Department. But if you Google Allen Centennial Gardens, it will actually come up for you.
Including a virtual tour, I think.
Yeah, and I think the virtual tour will probably be the first thing that comes up. And that's part of the website. But if you look down through your Google search, you'll see the homepage for the gardens.
All right, Joanne in Wales up next. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Larry. The last time that you had a garden program on, a lady called in right at the end of the program and was questioning why she wasn't getting green bell peppers.
Uh-huh.
And your guest couldn't help her, but my husband is quite a gardener, and he read in an organic book that green peppers are self-pollinating, and they need to have a breezy spot. And if you don't have a breezy spot, go past them occasionally and shake the plant.
Yeah.
My grandfather always, he was a wonderful vegetable gardener. He always said, plant your green bell peppers so that the leaves touch.
Right. Anyhow, I know that this isn't apropos to your program, but it was so late in your program last time I couldn't call in then.
Well, it's a good thank you for calling now. Thanks, Joanne.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Good tip there. Bill and Caroline, we're on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hi. The people that were worried about the deer damage to their plants and stuff.
Yeah.
We used a netting that's made for keeping birds out of your berries and stuff.
Yeah,
and just drape it over it, and the only problem is if you want to pick some flowers or vegetables or whatever, you have to kind of move it out of the way. But the deer they touch that and they just quit going at it.
Yeah,
that netting works extremely well. I have a friend with arborvitae, and that seems to be the only way that he can save the arborvitae. Keep in mind, we look like we're having winter like we did last year, and deer and rabbits were absolutely desperate to get anything to eat. And I did hear of reports where they even chewed through that netting simply to get the plant material, because the netting is so close to the plant material, they obviously can put their nose right up to it.
Oh, yeah, and they can probably push it in a little, too. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I usually recommend, if at all possible, some good tall burlapping around the plant materials, maybe a foot or two out, because that serves as double purpose. Not only is it going to keep those deer away, but it also helps with the windburn that you get in the winter on conifers as well.
Yeah, good points. Thanks, Bill.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate it. Ned in Chippewa Falls, on to you now. Hi, Ned.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions about blueberries. The first question is, we planted blueberries about 3 years ago in our backyard, and it's a rather clay soil, so we try to put pine needles on them. I also tend to heap lots of lawn clippings around the base of the blueberries to keep the weeds down, and want to know if I can put too much down there. Do I run a risk of suffocating them? And then my next question is, do blueberries benefit from being trimmed back in the fall in preparation for growth the next spring?
Okay, I think we have three questions there. One is, and we hear this all the time, obviously because the East Coast is acidic and they're acidic because of a lot of the conifers, everybody thinks that putting pine needles around their soil is going to make it acidic, and it simply won't. It took centuries of dropping of pine needles to create that type of acidity. Anything in the Ericaceae family here in Wisconsin is going to struggle. Not only do we not have low pH, but our water, our rains, the water that you water with are going to raise pH levels very quickly. So the only way that you're really going to do it is to prepare your beds with low pH materials like peat moss, and then you're going to have to do constant applications to keep that pH down. The pine needles alone will not do that. There was also the question about cutting them back. Actually, you do not have to cut back on blueberries. You want them to gain in size from year to year. As far as I know, I don't think you're really going to gain anything by cutting back on them. In fact, you're going to be losing some of the fruit. And as far as your lawn clippings, like everything, if you put too much of any kind of mulch around the plant, yes, you do run the risk of not getting your nutrients down in and suffocating. But again, the best thing you can do with the lawn clippings is to compost them first and then put them down. But certainly the lawn clippings will work as compost. They don't degrade as quickly as some of the other compost you might use.
Hmm.
An old blueberry gardener told me to put aluminum sulfate on.
Aluminum sulfate or magnesium sulfate are your real quick tricks. The thing to keep in mind, however, is you're using them over time, either aluminum or magnesium. They're both heavy metals. They can accumulate in the soil over time. Where I'm trying to acidify, I use straight elemental sulfur. It is very slow to break down, but if you're adding it every single year, then that is helping to keep the pH down. I actually tried to create a pH bed once, and I did with the materials that I use. I did have it started at 5.5. Within a year, it was already up to 7.2. So it kind of shows that we struggle here in the Midwest to keep pH down.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah. Thanks, Ned, for calling. Craig in Milwaukee. On to you now. Hi, Craig.
Hello. How you doing, sir?
Good.
I'm an over-the-road trucker, and I collect rocks and driftwood along, like, streams or mountains, and I've taken an interest in trying to grow moss in the rocks, and I'm wondering how much watering do they need a week, how much shade do they need, and what kind of fertilizer can you put on the moss? And also, you're downtown Madison, this rock garden you were talking about?
Yeah. Yes.
The rock garden is actually, our garden is right in the center of campus.
Oh, okay. I'm going to really look forward to seeing that.
And as far as moss, and I won't claim to be any tremendous expert on moss, Mark Dwyer, the director of horticulture at Rotary Botanical Gardens, probably knows as much about growing moss as anybody. But one of the tricks of moss is there are so many different kinds of them out there. They tend to be very specific to what they grow on. For instance, a moss that grows on a rock will not grow on a tree. They also can be very specific to specific types of rocks, very specific types of logs. It's a very complicated process in order to get moss to grow. I certainly would encourage you to get some books on moss growing. It's a much more complex situation than simply taking moss out of nature, plopping it down, and thinking that that's going to grow for
you. You're really going to need shade, and you're going to need moisture.
Well, and some mosses actually prefer sun. It's what people don't realize is that there are thousands and thousands of types of mosses, and they're very, very specific to where they grow.
One thing I like about the moss is usually it's going to be in a place where a weed's not going to, like, take over. It'd be easy to get the weed off. But I was going to put in a section of, like, fine grass, and I was thinking, just where can you buy fake fine grass? So, you know. Because when you put grass on, there's a lot of weeds that get in there, and I just don't really want to deal with that. Is there a place you can just buy a real nice fake fine grass?
Not that I know of.
No, me either.
So I gave up on the grass, but the moss and stuff, you know, it seems like it's easy to pick out a weed, you know?
Are you doing this because it's a shaded area?
Well, right. I have a shaded area, and I live by a lake, so I'm hoping the moisture will be more conducive to growing moss also.
Well, I would move away from grasses anyway, and I would go to sedges. Sedges are much more shade-tolerant. They're going to be tougher for the situation that you have. We have a native sedge.
What's that called? Sedges?
Sedge, S-E-D-G-E. We have a native one the scientific name is Carex. Carex pennsylvanica looks very much like a nice, light, fine grass. It'll do far better for you than any type of grass that you're trying to grow in the shade. Grasses prefer sun.
Yep.
All right. Well, appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Craig. You can join in, too, if you have a question for our guest today, Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, located on the UW-Madison campus. And we talked a lot about vegetables, and we got into moss. I haven't talked about flowers very much yet, but I hope we do get a chance to do that. That depends on you calling in with your question at 1-800-642-1234. Or again, email us at talk@wpr.org. And we have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast. Frank in Adams County, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
Morning.
First, I'm sitting by a nice south sunny window contemplating my foot of snow out there.
Yeah.
Then on this deer thing, I found a product last summer. It's called Liquid Fence. And you do not, I've got quite a large garden, and I have a lot of trouble with it. And what you do is you spray like a 3-foot border around the outside with this stuff. You do it once, you do it in another week, and then you do it once a month. And it does just a fantastic job. It keeps the rabbits, the raccoons, and the deer out. It's a wonderful product, but you do have to spray it at the right time.
Yep.
And like I said, there are many products, Liquid Fence being only one, that are effective. Again, if you have any size garden, you have to realize it's going to take a large quantity of whatever it is. And I also try to keep people away from generalization in time, like once a month. You have to keep in mind, if we go through a really rainy month, you're going to be applying that more than once a month. Don't think of it in those terms. Also, if you're getting a lot of new growth on any of the plant materials you're spraying, you go through a time period when the growth is rapid. That's not protected as well. So it does work. I just try to be a practical gardener. And I know in my garden, it would probably take, I'd have to be applying that stuff with 55-gallon drums. And it's fairly pricey.
Yeah.
So again, a lot of it's going to be experimenting with plant materials. That's what we do as gardeners, define what the deer in your area do or don't like.
Yeah, and thanks very much for calling, Frank. Appreciate your call. I want to get some others a chance here to get on. Tom in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling about trumpet vine, and I planted trumpet vine for hummingbirds, and I'm trying to get it to flower. And the problem is it grows like crazy, but I can't get it to flower. And I wonder if you have any ideas on what I should do to get flowers on my trumpet vine.
Yeah, trumpet vine actually takes time. It has to get to a certain maturity before it really puts on a lot of flowers. And unfortunately, I mean, that is an extremely aggressive vine. One of the places that I lived at one point, we had a telephone pole that it grew all the way to the top of the pole. And it was very floriferous at that time. But that's generally the biggest problem is people haven't given enough time for maturity. Obviously, it needs full sun. And, of course, throwing a little bit of high-phosphate fertilizer at it, if it's not getting enough of that nutrient, might help as well. But most of the time, it's just because the plant is not old enough yet.
Mm-hmm. All right.
What about cutting back, Ed?
That's not really going to do a great deal. I'm assuming you have not put this plant has not been in the ground that long.
Well, it's been its third year.
I'd keep letting that plant get growth and get some maturity on it.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Ellen in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you for calling.
Okay, my problem is I have a house that faces north. I live on a corner. It faces north, and then there's two sidewalk, you know, median trees that face the house. And so I've planted a lot. I gave up on shrubs. I do have some Annabelle hydrangeas, and then I have a lot of, you know, like sweet woodruff and wild violets, and also... lots and lots of hostas. And yep. So, but I do want a border before this public sidewalk of something that isn't a plant, and grass does not grow. I mean, it just does not. And I think the type of trees that are there just kind of sap everything that's, yep. you know, that are across the sidewalk, just are kind of nutrient sappers.
So what do you, Ed, do you have, are you onto this? Or
Are you asking what you can do as a grass alternative? Are you asking?
Yes.
Well, again, the carexes, the sedges. And there are also some shade-tolerant grasses. One of my favorite is the Hakona Kloa. That's the Japanese forest grass. It comes in a wide variety of variegated colors. As long as you have good drainage, that's a great plant. There's more grasses. There's actually a fair number of shade-tolerant ornamental grasses. But again, look to your sedges, and the scientific name again is carex. There are many, many carexes out there. They're very ornamental. You can get them foliage in golds and variegations, different heights, different forms as far as weeping or upright. Again, look to anybody that's teaching classes on shade gardening. Those are many of the types of plants that I talk about when I teach shade gardening classes.
And where do you teach those shade gardening classes?
actually, I'm in about 5 different states right now. So look to your public gardens. Look to your cooperative extension.
We have a lot of, you know, things going on here. I mean, we have this huge Whitnall Park that has, you know, the Brunner Botanical Gardens, plus they have a whole, you know, wild area where Nature Center. Maybe they can help me out.
Well, they would help. They certainly would have some ideas there, and that is a beautiful area, by the way. That center is great. And your UW Extension, your county extension office, the Master Gardener program there, and the extension horticulturists are going to be happy to help you out and give you some advice. But you're right about those sedges.
And I am actually doing a class on how to build and improve a shade garden in Milwaukee at the Public Art Museum. They have a flower show there. I can't tell you the date offhand. I don't have my calendar in front of me. But I think if you were to contact the Milwaukee Public Museum and ask them when they're doing that flower show, I will be in town and doing a talk on how to build and or improve a shade garden.
At the Milwaukee Public Museum.
That is correct.
All right. Thanks for calling, Ellen. Appreciate it. John in Milwaukee, we go to you next. Hi, John.
Hi. Looking for suggestions on keeping rabbits, mice, deer from oak seedlings. I spend 80 hours every year for the last 8 years for 150 oak seedlings. It's expensive. It takes sun away from the plant in the most important months of May and April, when you still need to protect against the deer, and the oaks grow the fastest. And it looks ugly in May. I've also tried soap, human hair, and now I'm using hardware cloth if it's less than 18 inches for the top end bud, poultry wire if it's greater. I appreciate any other suggestions.
Now, one of the problems with all the solutions that we used to use in the past, like the soap and the hair, is both rabbits and deer over time will adjust to them. And what they tell you to do is keep alternating whatever it is that you're using, and don't use any one thing. Obviously, fencing. That's going to be your best option to keep them away from something as valuable as oak seedling is fencing. But I will also say the one product that I have seen that seems to be effective if you want to spray something, and this is very, very cheap, are the hot peppers. They do seem to be very effective. And a recipe that was given to me that I think works extremely well, I use it myself, is you take 12 eggs, you separate the yolks from the whites, and that's because the yolk is going to booger up the end of your sprayer. You put the in a 3-gallon sprayer, you put these 12 egg whites, and then you put in equivalent 12 egg yolks with the egg beaters. And then you find the hottest possible chili sauce out there you can. I use one called Dave's Insanity Sauce. You mix that combination together, cheap 3-gallon mix, and spray it. And this was recipe was given to me by a gentleman who lives on the edge of woods and had enormous amounts of deer and rabbit damage. And in the 2 years he's used the product, he's had no damage. And I have to say that I've had the same results.
Thank you very much. I'll do that.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Mike in Chippewa Falls, we go to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. So a couple years ago, 3 years ago, I just for the heck of it, I managed to get a couple of acorns seeds to germinate. I'm not a gardener. And 2 years ago, I transplanted them, and during the process, I got them pretty close together, and they're doing well. But I'm wondering, as they grow, will their close proximity, they're about 2 inches, will that jeopardize both of them or either one of them, or do you have any opinion on that?
Are you growing them in a pot, or is this in the ground?
No, 2 years ago I put them in the ground.
Well, definitely oak is going to need much more room to grow into than what you've given them. One of the fallacies on oaks, if these are still small seedlings, one of the fallacies is that they develop a taproot so that you cannot dig them. They do put out a taproot, but the taproot only goes down as far as that plant finds water, and then that taproot stops. And over time, that taproot disappears and an oak tree becomes fibrous rooted like any other tree. So my suggestion is probably in the spring, when it's early yet, before they've put on any kind of leaves, if they're small seedlings, I would dig one of them and get them separated, because that's simply not enough room as they grow and develop. And the more age you let get on them, the deeper they might put that initial taproot.
I did not know if I could separate them in the pot. I would have killed one or both trying to separate them, so I didn't try that when they were in the pot. But I'll give that a shot then.
All right.
Good. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Ed Lyons, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking all things gardening here with Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. And Ed, you mentioned you were going to be talking at the Milwaukee Public Museum or giving a presentation, but you're also going to be doing it at the Garden Expo, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct. And there's something I should mention as well to all of you that are looking for education. The Garden Expo in February is 3 days. It's held here in Madison. And all 3 days, there are speakers all day long, multiple speakers every hour on every topic you can possibly imagine. So I would strongly encourage you, come look online, find the Garden Expo. It's sponsored by the Wisconsin Public Television. They'll show you a schedule of who's speaking when. You can get an awful lot of education in a short period of time at an event like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Shelley Ryan and I will be, we're there every year, and we'll be there again to do our little dog and pony show, as we call it, answering questions from listeners about gardening. And that'll be on Saturday morning of the weekend of the event. So that's going to be, it's always a lot of fun, and looking forward to it. Kathy in Delafield, you're up. Hi, Kathy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I have two climbing roses that are on an arbor, and each year they start out really looking beautiful, and then they get progressively uglier because I have Japanese beetles, which I discovered about 2 years ago. So I'm up against this war of trying to get the Japanese beetles off of there. And I don't know if the plant itself is being mostly affected by these beetles or if it just kind of loses its leaves from some other diseases. But that's the problem. All the leaves start to fall off.
Part of the issue is probably the variety of climbing rose you have as well. Many climbing roses just don't do well for us here in Wisconsin, and I recommend to people either to go with the Canadian Explorer series, and you'll know them because they'll all have French Explorer names like William Baffin and John Cabot.
Okay, I think I have a Will. It is a William Baffin.
Okay, well, the Japanese beetles certainly can be defoliating them. They're devastating. That can certainly be an issue as well, probably your primary issue at this point.
Yeah. They love roses.
So maybe I should just replace it with maybe a climbing hydrangea or something of that nature.
Well, I hate to say this, but I joke that I'm glad that we don't have a major rose garden at Allen Centennial. The Japanese beetles are going to be an enormous issue. They're getting worse before they're getting better.
Yes.
And they will be a challenge. There are some roses out there that have some resistance, some shrub roses. But in the same regards, they are going to be a large challenge for all of us in the immediate future.
And there really is no sprays or anything that take care of those.
There is a systemic that the Bayer company puts out, but what we have found on roses, it varies according to which kind of rose that you're using it on.
Okay.
It also seems to help with the foliage, but not the flowers.
Okay, yeah, that's really are concentrated on the flowers.
Right. And that's why you're growing your roses are for the flowers anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. By the way, Jim Packard's telling me that you'll be giving your class at the Milwaukee Art Museum.
Oh, I'm sorry.
During Art in Bloom, and Art in Bloom runs April 2nd through April 5th. So it's not the Milwaukee Public Museum, it's the Milwaukee Art Museum. So that we got that straightened out, and we know it's now April 2nd through the 5th. So we've got it straightened out. Let's go to Jerry and Thorpe next. Hi, Jerry. Thank you very much for calling.
Hello. Your guest has made several comments about sedges being a good plant for a shade garden or shaded area. My experiences and understanding of sedges is they prefer wet soil, almost a swamp plant. Can he comment on that, please?
Certainly. And I use the hosta as a great example of this. When you have such a large group of plants, people tend to peg them all as having one cultural condition. We do this to the hostas. Every hosta is a shade plant that likes its feet kept moist. And obviously, when you have such a large group of plants, there is a huge variety of plant materials within that. And that is true of the sedges. In fact, the Carex pennsylvanica that I mentioned to you that is our native sedge that grows in dry woodland soils, very typical of Wisconsin. So, again, you have to look and see that there's a huge number of sedges out there. Look at what the cultural conditions are of each. Some prefer sun, some prefer shade, some prefer wet soil, some prefer dry. There's just so many of them that are available, you'll find one for your application, or you'll find multiple plants for your application.
Sure. Thank you, Jerry. Jeff in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I've been to Allen Garden. It's incredible. And I saw in the water, in the pond, I believe it's a lotus. It creates this incredible pod with these big holes in it in which there are seeds. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
That is correct. That is Nilumbo, or the lotus.
What's the name of it?
Well, Nilumbo is the scientific name, but it is a lotus, yes.
And are those seeds something that if you were to plant them, they would grow?
You know, you're going outside my area of expertise there. I'm not sure. Mm. We do have a native lotus. It's Nilumbo lutea. It's yellow flowering. In fact, if you go out near Picnic Point in that area, you'll see it growing right in Lake Mendota. The ones that we have at Allen Centennial Gardens are tropical. So there's a variety of both. And I'm afraid I don't really have a lot of knowledge or expertise on propagating them from seed.
Well, if they're tropical, then how do you, from year to year, continue to have them? Do you have to just throw them away and then get new ones?
We don't. The water is deep enough that ours will actually overwinter. But most people, their home ponds don't have 4 feet of depth of water.
Oh.
And so what people will do is probably they'll pull them out of the water in the fall. Mm-hmm. One good thing that you can do with either your water lilies or your lotus is take them pot and all and put them in a black garbage bag, moist, and seal that garbage bag, and that moisture will keep the root systems of them until you put them back in the water in the spring. Some people use swimming pools, the kids' swimming pool in the basement, but most people would have to overwinter them. They don't have the water depth.
Okay. How can I find out if those seeds are propagatable?
I would contact probably one of the, go online, look for places that specialize in water plants. There's a really good book called The Encyclopedia of Water Plants written by Greg and Sue Spikert. They may address it in there. I'm not entirely sure. But some of the nurseries that specialize in those plant materials, I'm sorry, where were you from again?
I'm in Madison.
One of the really great nurseries here that might be able to help you is the Flower Factory. Their address is Stoughton. They grow a lot of water plants and plant materials. I bet because they propagate, David and Nancy Nedvick, I'm sure they'd be able to answer your question or direct you to somebody who can.
Yeah. Great. Thank you very much.
That's a great place to visit, too.
Oh, it's one of my favorites.
I love going out there. Paul in Cascade, it's your turn. Hi, Paul. Paul, are you there? No, we lost Paul. John. That's John. John, are you there? Nope. Let's go to Paul now. Paul in Cascade. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Okay. Would you repeat that recipe you gave for keeping deer out of your garden with egg whites and hot sauce?
Yes. 3 gallons of water. A dozen eggs, separate out the whites of those eggs. You're going to use only the whites and throw away your yolks or use them in baking. And then you'll use an equivalent amount of egg beater. I think it's 3 eggs per container of egg beater. And all you're doing there is replacing those yolks. That'll go through your sprayer and not clog it up. And then you use the hottest pepper sauce that you can get your hands on. As I said, I use one called Dave's Insanity Sauce.
Yeah.
It only takes half a dozen drops of that.
Oh, not the whole bottle?
No, don't dump the whole bottle in there because that actually could be intense enough that it'll burn the foliage on your plants.
And then have you ever heard of a testing compost like you do garden soil?
Absolutely. Compost vary tremendously. So there are different ways to test the compost to see what the nutrient content of that compost is.
Would anybody be able to do that?
Offhand, I would say your soil analysis people probably would also do compost.
Yeah, the soil and plant analysis laboratories of the University of Wisconsin, I believe, do that. You could go online to Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory, University of Wisconsin, and it will say right on their website.
Okay. That's not an extreme position, then? You are aware of it, eh?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And John in Watertown. Hi, John.
Good morning. I just finished shoveling myself out of a foot of snow, and I naturally thought of strawberries.
Yeah.
I planted a strawberry bed this summer, and by the time the strawberries grew up, the grass is there with it. Is there any product on the market that I can put over that? It'll kill the grass and keep the strawberry.
Well, not safely. Your best bet is weeding and then getting some mulch in with those strawberries. When you first plant your strawberries, it's probably a good idea to heavily mulch with some straw. Straw is, as I usually don't recommend for most plant materials because it does not degrade and compost, but on strawberries it works extremely well. The shiny surface of it helps the water to run away from the fruit and then also provides the weed protection for you. But I don't. Again, you might contact Extension. I don't grow strawberries myself, so I'm not entirely sure that there's herbicide out there that would work for you and not. You know, and again, you're putting herbicides on strawberries, and I'm not sure you really want to be doing that as well.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Linda in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just had some information on the lotus propagation.
Okay.
I've got the book American Horticultural Society, and it says to divide in the spring and sow scarified seeds at 77 degrees.
Okay. So you actually have to take and scarify the seed, but it sounds like it's possible.
Yep. All right. Thank you, Linda.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, appreciate that very much. And Fran in Delafield, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. Actually, I have four, but probably two. Here's the first two. One would be stump removal. Any quick suggestions on how to do that? It's not a really big stump.
Usually people use a stump grinder. Is this a situation where you cannot use a stump grinder?
I suppose I could.
And they make small ones. Most of your rental companies where you would rent anything
grinder.
Else would have a small stump grinder.
Okay. Okay, my next question, my yard is fairly shady. I'd like to grow some deciduous fast-growing shrubs along the edges as kind of a living fence. Do you have any suggestions for that?
Oh, there's many out there. The physocarpus are extremely popular right now. Those are the nine barks. You can get them in gold foliage and purple foliage. There's a number of shrubs. Now, if they're on the edge, they're getting sun then, correct?
Yes, but limited. There's...
All right. Well, we're going to have to ponder that for a while here with our guest, Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Garden, here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, located on the UW-Madison campus. Really happy to have him along. Certainly, if you want to join in, a couple of open lines, we'll get you on at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Fran in Delafield wondering about some fast-growing shrubs that she could plant along her, I think, the property line probably.
Yes, and she had a little bit of shade. I'll tell you a couple of my favorite ones I have in my garden, and that's because they have a variegated leaf. And I certainly think that adds a lot of interest, especially in the shade. There is a mock orange, and I usually don't recommend mock orange. I think it's a single interest plant with the flowers only in the spring. But there's one. There's actually two. One's called Variegata. The other one is called E.A. Bowles. It's named after somebody. Has a variegated leaf. It's in my shade garden. I love it because after the flowers are gone, you still have the variegation. There's also a bluebeard, the Caryopteris, that is called Snow Fairy. I have two Snow Fairies in my garden. They are dieback shrubs. They'll die back to the ground but come back up in the spring. They have a variegated leaf on them, and they just shine in the dark as well. So those are two good ones that you might look at.
All right. And thanks for that question. And someone else was wondering about scarifying seeds. How do you really go about doing that?
Yeah, that's actually just all it means is that you have to nick that seed with something. These are seeds that have adapted to just sit in the ground for a very, very long time until something disturbs and puts a nick into them. Morning glories are probably one of the most common ones that you actually have to put a little bit of a nick in so that they open up. So all scarification means is you're taking a knife or a file, something of that nature, and giving it a nick so that the moisture gets into that seed and cracks open the hull of the seed.
Josh in Superior, we turn to you now. Hi, Josh.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
A friend of mine grows a wide variety of magnolias from the southern part of the United States here, and they're perfectly hardy in Hayward, Wisconsin, but the only problem is they're not commercially available. They're seeds that have been sent to him or seeds that he's collected from various places. And I'm wondering if there are any nurseries that actually sell magnolias in Wisconsin that sell magnolias from the northern edge of their ranges. And I also have another comment to make. If anyone's interested in growing hardy lady slippers, there's a company called Spangle Creek Labs in northern Minnesota, and they sell a wide variety of native lady slippers that are very hardy as well. And I'll take comments off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, what do you think?
For magnolias that would be hardy in that area, I would give Green Bay Botanical Garden a call. I'm not familiar with nurseries in northern Wisconsin, and it certainly would be advisable not only to find plants that are supposed to be hardy in that area, but they're also from what we call a providence, a more northern providence versus a southern providence.
I was just looking through Jung's catalog, and they sell a magnolia vine, but quite different from what he was talking about. The vine actually sounds really nice with a nice fruit.
Correct. Now, there are many magnolia that were certainly going to be hardy in that area. Any of the Seven Sisters should be hardy up in that area, and we call them that because they have names like Pinky, Betty, Ann. There's a number. The Lebner magnolia should be hardy for you in that area. But he was talking about some very specific seed out of the south, and without knowing what plants those are, I can't really address that specific tree.
Chris in Columbus, it's your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Say, I'm wondering about how to do a root ball Christmas tree instead of a cut Christmas tree. And then this fall, I did not cut back my wildflower garden, as I had heard that that would provide shelter and food for birds. And so I'm wondering how to address that in the spring. And I'll take my answer off here.
All right. First off, on the Christmas tree, you'll notice that there was a time period when that was a very popular thing to do. Save a tree, don't cut it down so you can plant it in the spring. The problem with that is you're trying to pull a plant out of dormancy. It's a conifer. Conifers need to go dormant for the winter. So you pull it inside in a root ball in the winter, and you've pulled it out of its dormancy. That means you've got to put it back into dormancy. Either that, or you're going to keep it inside until spring when you can plant it. It's not going to like to be inside at all. You don't have enough light. You don't have enough humidity. So you're probably going to lose the plant anyway. You'll notice that just is not a big thing anymore because it was not a successful thing to do. The idea was good, but it's just very hard to pull plants like that in and out of dormancy and then have them survive what you're doing to them. And as far as your wildflower garden, I leave anything I possibly can in my garden to stand through the winter, especially if it has winter interest or food value. And then it's a very simple process. When you get into spring, I start working in my garden about mid-April. You can certainly go in and cut down those plant materials then, and no different than if you would in the fall.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that question. Lyle in St. Charles, Minnesota, we go to you now. Hi.
Hi. Say, I have a question for you. My wife and I are looking at putting in raspberries this spring. And what size would you recommend? I mean, there's two of us. We can put in anywhere from 10 square feet to, you know, 50 by, 20 if we wanted. Looking for, you know, for harvesting to eat, but also for jams, jellies, and freezing or canning.
I think the amount of space is how much labor and time do you want to put into this.
Okay.
Certainly, raspberries can be fairly intensive. And you have to know with which variety you put in, whether they need to be cut down annually, whether they're going to fruit on old wood or whether they're going to fruit on new wood. You certainly want to look at doing everbearings probably because you're going to get more fruit through the season. We have some everbearing raspberries in the gardens, and we had students coming through picking fruit off them right up until about the time that they severely froze. So there's a large number of varieties out there that take a different amount of work. It can be a fair amount of work. So I think my suggestion is to start with a smaller plot, see how much work that is for you, and then do I have the time that I want to increase the size of this bed?
Okay.
All right.
Very good. Yep, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Andrea of Woodruff moved to a home on a spring-fed lake, wants to plant a fruiting, flowering tree attractive to birds. She has sandy soil. Any suggestions?
Well, probably the most popular one that many of us put in the ground, and it's a landscaping tree. It's called Amelanchier, which is the common name you hear most often here, is serviceberry. Mm-hmm. And it's a great tree because not only does it produce a fruit that is, it's actually delicious to humans, too.
Yes, it is.
In upstate New York, we had one that we called the shadblow, and my grandmother used to make shadberry pie, and it was phenomenal. But it's great for bird food. It has a beautiful white flower in the spring, so you get that as well, and it gets gorgeous red fall color, and that may be why it's very popular as a landscape tree. It's also very tough and adaptable, and you're looking at some very dry, sandy soils there. Key will be, if you've got sand, as that root system establishes, you're going to have to keep an awful lot of water to it to get that root system established.
Yep, good points. Barbara in Eau Claire, on to you. Hi, Barbara.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What can we do for you?
I'm calling today to ask about sunflowers. I love growing them, and I've noticed that when there's been a strong rain or wind, they kind of droop. So I was wondering if it is necessary to stake them up and how to do that.
Actually, there are, again, so many different sunflowers out there. If they're growing in an area where you think they're going to get exposed to heavy rains and winds, I would certainly then select out some of the shorter varieties. Obviously, the less tall they get, the less exposed they're going to be to falling over. There are some of the very large mammoth sunflowers, though, that also put on a stem that is very, very strong and rigid. So I think you need to look at the site, see just how much wind and rain that you're getting, and judge it accordingly. And of course, if it looks like they are starting to kind of topple a little bit, then go out with either a bamboo or fake bamboo stake and stake them up.
Okay, that makes sense.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have some open lines, so you can get on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Someone emailed in and wondered if the recipe you gave with the eggs and the water and so forth and the hot pepper works in the winter as well as the summer.
I have not heard of anybody trying it in the winter because basically what it's most effective on is foliage. I would think that it would work on your conifers in the winter. It's certainly worth a try. When you consider the ingredients that goes into that, the 3 gallons, you really can't get much cheaper than that. So give it a try and see how it works, and then you can let all the rest of us know.
That's a very, very good point. And the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And lots of callers coming up on online. How do you permanently get rid of buckthorn? That's another emailed question.
I usually don't try to recommend herbicides if at all possible, but to permanently get rid of buckthorn, you do have to cut the upper portion of it off, and there are a couple of herbicides that you can get that you literally, we call it painting that herbicide on the stump, and then that herbicide will go down into the root system and kill off the root system as well. One of the problems with buckthorn is, like many plants are very defensive. They know how to take care of themselves. So if you simply are cutting them off, they're going to send back even more shoots because they're going to make sure that they survive what you tried to do to them. So really the most effective method here is to paint the stumps.
And it can be an onerous job, and you have to kind of keep at it because sometimes it comes back up or what have you. So, unfortunately, that's about the only way to do it permanently.
It is, unfortunately.
John in Wausau, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks. I have a bunch of rutan rose bushes, I think that's how you pronounce them. And the horse keeps going over there and eating off all the little red bulbs. And I was just wondering if that's going to harm the horse any or not, and I'll take my answer off here.
When you say the little red balls, are you talking about the hips, the rose hips that are left behind after the rose flower is gone?
I think we lost him, so we don't know for sure.
Yeah, rose hips obviously will not hurt the horse. We make rose hip tea. And if that's what he was referring to, which I think he probably is, won't harm the horse at all.
On to Mark in Waukesha. Mark, hello to you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I've got Annabelle hydrangeas. I know they flower on old wood. Well, the problem was the rabbits were eating off the wood in the wintertime. And when we got shoots, we got these what I call neutered flowers. They really didn't bloom, but they had something of a flower appearance to them. What do you recommend for, I suppose, protect the shrub, but other than that, phosphate fertilizer, high phosphate?
Probably if you're trying to regenerate growth, vegetative growth, then you want nitrogen. There's a very simple way of remembering what each of those, when you're looking at the analysis of a fertilizer, and there's N, P, and K, keep in mind that the N is for vegetative growth. The P, the phosphorus, is for flowering. So that's
why, what I want. I want to get them the flower, and I want bigger flowers.
Okay, then that you want to go with a heavier phosphorus in order to do that. And again, if you have hydrangeas that are blooming on that old growth, then you're probably going to want to cage those plants in the winter or do something to protect them from that damage.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your help. You got a great show.
Thank you very much, Mark. Bill in Whitewater, we're on to you now. Hi, Bill.
My question is, it seems like all my oak trees, my white oaks, seem to be, their leaves are real shriveled, and the bark seems to be falling off, what that might be.
Well, I hope you don't have oak wilt. That is the most common disease right now that are taking out wonderful matures oaks here in Wisconsin and other areas as well. With the bark stripping off, that sounds pretty serious. My recommendation is find a good local arborist and get them out there and looking at those trees in the spring. It could be a number of different issues. If bark is coming off, there might be some type of insect that's actually getting in and in that cambium tissue. So oaks are pretty valuable. Get a good arborist out there.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to affect like the red oaks, or they look fine.
Yeah, there's different diseases that can be specific to the whites that don't affect the reds.
Okay. And a certified arborist. Look for a certified arborist.
Yeah, most definitely. Again, it's very difficult to ever diagnose plants, and I hate to do that over the air without actually seeing the plant. And most of the time, your best bet when you have issues, especially something as valuable as an oak, is call in a professional. It'll be worth whatever they charge you to find out exactly and specifically what your issue is.
Yeah. All right, I'll do that.
All right, thanks, Bill. And good luck. Ann in Janesville, on to you now. Hi, Ann.
Hello. I just have been enjoying the program immensely and sadly commiserated with the person about the roses and the Japanese beetles.
Yeah.
But the recent caller talking about raspberries, what can I do to save my raspberries from the Japanese beetles?
Oh, boy. Again, you're basically either picking those Japanese beetles off of the raspberries.
Floating row cover.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I grew up with Japanese beetles. They were in upstate New York 30 years ago, and they've been making their way out here. There's not easy solutions. All I can tell you is that nature over time does at least modify those populations, and they'll always be here. And again, you might want to check with Cooperative Extension and see what their recommendations. I don't do raspberries myself. We'll probably be addressing that ourselves in the garden next year because we do have them at Allen Centennial.
Well, I was able to save my birch tree with a Bayer product.
Correct.
And that worked wonderfully.
We will be using that ourselves in the gardens. They are affecting a lot of vines, like our climbing hydrangeas. They're in the lindens. They're in the birches. So obviously they're in plant materials where you can't get in and pick them off, and the systemic does work. I can't tell you, though, I have not looked into it, whether that systemic would show up in the fruit of a raspberry or not.
Okay. I think it's not acceptable to use. I do have a compliment, however. Allen Centennial Garden was a setting for my daughter's wedding 6 years ago, and it was just a beautiful setting.
Well, we love it.
I can understand, and we always kind of go back around her anniversary just to enjoy it again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling. It is a beautiful place, and probably quite a few weddings and events there.
Yes, we're very busy May through October with weddings on weekends.
Someone called in. We had an earlier caller from northern Wisconsin who wondered about magnolia trees, and someone else emailed or phoned in and said, magnolia trees can be purchased from Yellow River Nursery in Spooner, Wisconsin. So that's a place, Yellow River Nursery in Spooner. She, Christine, has had one. She bought there 4 years ago and still growing strong. So yeah. There you
have
it.
One of the great things about a radio show is what we don't know, somebody else can call in.
That's exactly right. Kay in Mondovi, on to you now. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I have a question about asparagus, but a second question, if you have time, is how to get rid of gophers. And the first question is asparagus. My patch is very old. Every spring I go through it early with a small rototiller to break up the soil and try to get the soil ready. But I have a quackgrass problem. So how can I get rid of some of that quackgrass?
That's going to be a real challenge. The only thing that I can tell you, that quackgrass probably should be growing in green before your asparagus comes up. So you'll have to hit, if you can hit it, and you're going to have a short time period, hit it with a quackgrass specific herbicide before that asparagus is up.
So I've been putting rototilling and then putting preen on it, so I should wait for this quackgrass to come up, put the preen on,
preen is not going to affect a plant that's already coming up, and you may be making your problem worse by rototilling.
Yes, you are.
Because what's happening is that quackgrass is dropping seed, and you are bringing that seed to surface where it's going to continue to grow. So I would recommend probably doing some kind of a straw mulch hit with the herbicide. You're just constantly regenerating this problem with the rototilling.
Straw mulch and a herbicide.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Preen is only effective on plant materials before they're actually up and growing. So.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. And Justin in Chippewa Falls, hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I had a question. I'm trying to figure out what kind of tree this is. I do tree work around the power lines, and I cut them all the time. They're usually only in yards. They look like a mix between a Lombardy poplar and a cottonwood, and I'm trying to figure out what they are.
It's not your standard poplar, is it?
No, it looks like it's got cottonwood leaves, but it grows like a really big Lombardy poplar.
Well, Lombardies grow in a very columnar form. Is this growing columnar?
No, it gets big, long branches on it. It's someone told me it was a cottonless cottonwood, but I don't know what that is. So,
without really seeing the tree, it's hard to tell. I mean, our sycamores grow wide-spreading and look very much like a cottonwood. They have the same leaf. They're in the same family. So maybe you have that. It might be sycamore.
And you could actually, if you wanted to email a picture. You could email me a picture, and I could get it on to Ed and take a look at it, and we could figure out what it was. So at some point, if you're out there with a camera, get a shot of it, and we'll try and identify it for you. And good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, Ed, 90 minutes goes by pretty fast when you're having fun.
It does.
You'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
I would love to.
Ed Lyon is director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, located on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. And Go ahead and put Allen Centennial Gardens into your search engine, and you're going to get a virtual tour. Will probably pop up first of the gardens, and then you'll find the website, and you'll be able to go to it. And it's really a wonderful place. I've been there many times and enjoy it every single time. Well, hope you have a great weekend. Coming up Monday, we've got ice fishing and why we do it. There's a great book out with authors Lane Kennedy and Greg Brining of the Twin Cities. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.